I'm Taylor Holbrooks, host of Morning Edition. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make live streams like this one difficult to keep going. Stand up for public media and help fortify WYPR's future. Tell your member of Congress you support WYPR by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org, and thanks.
And good afternoon. Welcome. It's midday today. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. And today it's midday on pets. Dr. Lisa Garrity is back once again with answers to your questions about your beloved critters. As we move into the summer months, are you preparing for a car trip or a flight? Let's talk about traveling with your pets. Also, as the weather warms up, beware of issues like hyperthermia and allergies as our pets spend more time outside. And as they age, the needs of pets change as well. What's the best way to handle our senior pets? How can we adjust our homes and routines to take care of their unique aging challenges? If you have a question about cats or dogs or any other pet, give us a call. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Dr. Lisa Garrity is a veterinarian and the medical director at the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital. And Dr. Garrity joins us on Zoom. Hey, Dr. Garrity, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
And we should mention to folks that your household has plenty of pets, so you have personal and professional experience in this regard. You've got a few kids in your house, plus, is it four cats and three dogs? Is that right?
Yes.
So we
Yes, and they range from one-year-old to almost 14-year-old, the dogs.
The whole gamut.
I've got the whole spectrum.
So the dogs are Tucker, Ricky, and Billy, and the cats are Oliver, Luce, Sam, and Lena. So that is a that's a full load. That's terrific. With the summer travel season upon us, let's talk a little bit about traveling with pets. There are a lot of dogs and cats that are flying these days. I don't fly as much as I used to. I used to have a job that required me to travel quite a bit, but I don't travel nearly as much as I used to. But when I do travel, we always see lots of doggies and cats in the cabin with everybody. Is it, if you have a larger dog that can't go in the cabin, what's it like to put a dog in the cargo hold? Is that ever recommended?
Yeah, I think that the airlines are pretty good about having climate controlled areas of the cargo hold, and the dogs should be used to being in a crate, so that they feel comfortable while they're in there. So I think they do fine with it, you know. Yeah, if the little ones can travel on the plane with the client, that's the best. Often they will also need to make sure that they travel with their rabies certificate, whether they are going on the airline or going in a car. So make sure that, you know, you always have that with you when you travel with your pet.
Oh, you actually have to take the certificate with you, the little...
It's just a good idea to have it just in case anything happens.
I guess it was Forbes magazine did an article about the airlines that are most friendly to pets. Turns out Alaska Airlines is considered by consumers to be the most friendly to pets.
Wow.
And Hawaiian Airlines is number three. And some of the larger ones, United and American and Delta, they're kind of down at the bottom of the list. So, I mean, I guess if you're an airline, you'd rather have human customers than canine or feline customers. But I guess, if you have to fly, as you say, take the rabies certificate with you.
They
do have to be used to the crate. So maybe if they're not generally in a crate, I guess you could maybe practice a little bit before you left and have them in the crate a little bit before you go.
And some dogs actually with car travel get motion sick. That's one of the things, or anxiety with travel. And so, you know, you can talk to your veterinarian about getting medications to give them before travel, so that they don't get motion sick or to reduce their anxiety a little bit.
Yeah, we dog sit a wonderful favorite dog of ours who has a tough time traveling in the backseat of the car, even on short trips. There's usually vomiting involved on those little trips. But that can be medicated. I mean, the way humans do. I mean, is it something equivalent to Dramamine or something like that?
It is. It's a dog version of it. It's called Serenia. The drug is actually meropatam, and you give it about an hour to 2 hours before travel.
Yeah, so you got to be a heads up. You got to be looking ahead for that.
Yes.
How about allergies? People are talking that this particular season for humans is a really rough season for allergies. All of my friends that are afflicted by that have been complaining mightily about it. Are dogs and cats subject to the same kinds of, you know, pollen allergies and elements in the air in the springtime that humans are?
They are, actually, and it's funny that you mentioned they're seeing it more in people, because I actually have been seeing it more in pets in the last few weeks. Dogs can get, itchy paws where they'll lick and lose hair and get red from touching the grass. They can get allergic conjunctivitis where their eyes get very red and get like a mucousy discharge. And sometimes they just need an antihistamine eye drop that's over the counter. So we do see that.
We have a question from my colleague here at WIPR, Rachel Bay, who's our senior writer and editor here. And she has a question about allergies with one of her dogs.
I have two dogs. Mm-hmm. The one I'm asking about is almost 12 years old. His name is Brooks. And he is allergic to chicken. We discovered this a few years ago. He kept getting ear infections. And finally, our vet said, maybe you need to eliminate chicken from his diet. Maybe he's allergic to chicken. And I've heard anecdotally that chicken allergies are really common in dogs. And I was wondering how common those allergies really are. And do chicken allergies in dogs relate at all to antibiotics given to chickens?
So what
I have
do you
not
think?
Heard a I have not heard a correlation between chicken allergy and antibiotics. But my own dog Tucker has an allergy to chicken and turkey. Chicken and turkey proteins are probably the most common allergen, food allergen. And so you can have dogs cross react to turkey if they're allergic to chicken. You also have to make sure that you read ingredients, even though you buy a treat that says salmon treats. One of the ingredients in there could be chicken meal or egg or one of the other ingredients that could cause a flare up of allergies. But food allergies we do see in dogs as well as environmental allergies.
Can dogs and cats contract the same human diseases as humans can? I mean, were dogs and cats getting COVID? Do they get norovirus? Do they get colds and flu? Are animals, subject to the same kind of bacterial dangers that the rest of us are?
Yeah, there are some zoonotic diseases, and that just means that it crosses over between species. We have seen some cats get, the bird flu, especially eating raw diets, because that chicken or protein source is contaminated. I have had myself, maybe this is too much information, scabies or mange. I got it from a pet who I was treating. So the mange mite can actually get on people just for a very short term. I have suspected that norovirus or GI viruses can go from people to pets because I've seen a correlation, but I've never seen it confirmed, and I haven't looked up research on that. But I've had a few families where the dog is also sick when the family was.
Yeah, that's a whole other level of complication now when you're taking care of a sick child. You could have a sick cat, too. Dr. Lisa Garrity is the medical director at the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital. It's Midday on Pets. We're talking about pets. If you have a question for Dr. Garrity, we'd love to hear from you. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Let's go to Middle River. Mary Ann is on the line. Welcome to the show with Dr. Garrity.
Hi there, Dr. Garrity and Tom and all of our pet-loving neighbors. How you doing?
We're doing great.
Hi.
My question is easy, I think. I have two senior girls, cats. And at our latest vet visit, the vet didn't tell us all that it was time they had some blood work done to see that, you know, to establish a baseline, see what's what. And when I inquired, they said, oh, that'd be about $279 per cat. I don't have that kind of money. So I checked out with a couple of other veterinary practices in my area, and it's all about the same price across the board. Now, the cats are pretty much healthy so far, but, you know, I want to do the best for my little pet companions. What other alternatives do we have? There are no such things as low-price vets anymore. Indeed, we just got our rabies shots at the county where it was $9 a pet. The vet would cost 50 or more per pet. So, you know, what's a person to do if you want to keep your pets in good health but don't have that kind of money?
All right.
And I guess I better take the answer off the air.
Okay. Well, thank you, Marianne, for that question. And I'm sure it's a question, Dr. Garrity, that a lot of people have. I mean, owning a pet these days is not it's not a cheap endeavor. It costs money to keep them supplied with the meds they need, with the food they need. What's your response? There's a survey that the American Veterinarian Association did just this month. They published it. It was done by the PetSmart charities that said 52% of pet owners in the United States report having skipped needed veterinary care in the past year. 37% said that they visited the vet, but they declined one or more of the recommendations that the vet made because of the expense. This is a real issue, isn't it?
It is. And just like everything in the economy where it's costing more for housing, gas, food, whichever, you know, the veterinary industry is no different. You know, to answer Marianne's question, you know, maybe she can speak with her vet about running a smaller panel, but to still get baselines on kidney function, thyroid. You know, we don't have to run the largest chemistry panel. We can run a smaller one for less money and still get, you know, some answers to monitor their health as they age. It's become a problem. Some veterinary hospitals have, you know, wellness plans where you can pay ahead, and then some of those costs are covered throughout the year. Sometimes you can spread it out where they can come back for blood work in a few months and not have to do it right at that visit. We often will have clients come in, as we call a tech visit, just to draw blood or do a blood pressure or something at a later time.
All right. Well, there's some answers for you, Marianne. I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling. Let's go back to the phones. Ed is on the line in Towson. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have an 11-year-old lab, Maisie, who's really healthy. I exercise her daily. In fact, we just got back from a 3-mile walk at the park that we do every day. And my question is, she always was getting up early, like at 5:30, to eat breakfast. She wants to eat early, and she's always done that for her whole life. And you almost could almost set your clock to her, you know, getting up. I mean, it was like an alarm clock at 5:30. And then by 6, we'd feed her and I'd walk her. And then now she's getting up. She wants to get, it's like around 4:15. And she's driving me crazy because she's jumping on the bed to get me up. And I rub her ears to calm her down for a while. And then it does for a little bit. And then she's back to get him. And once I finally get up and feed her and take her out and whatnot, she's fine. And I go back to bed. And I don't know if you have anything to recommend for that. Just so she doesn't get up so early in the morning, and, you know, as she's been doing.
Yeah, and Ed, I'm interested, does this happen in the summer and the winter? In other words, when it's dark outside
It's been going on about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been summer.
Yeah, like the time, you're thinking about the time change. Dogs will adjust their schedule.
Oh, I know that. I know that.
Daylight saving, but it wouldn't last the 6 months. It only lasts for like a week or so. You know, is it that she's getting up for the food specifically, or does she have to use the bathroom?
I mean, labs are notoriously always hungry anyway, but yeah, she doesn't need to go. I mean, after I feed her and all that and take her out and she does her business, but that's not the main reason that she wants to be fed. And
she wants to be fed, yeah. So one of the things I think of is if her appetite is kind of increased and driving her to get up early. There is a disease called Cushing's disease that it's where the body produces too much of its steroid and it actually increases appetite. Has she been panting more lately, increasing her drinking or urination? That may be the reason.
Okay, I haven't noticed that. What you call it, Cushing's disease?
Yeah, sometimes that can be the reason that they want food all the time.
Okay. So
unless her diet has changed and her caloric intake has changed or any kind of schedule change at your house. But that's what I would think is if she just wants more and more food.
Okay. So how do I get that diagnosed? Pardon me?
You can talk to your vet about it. They start out with just routine blood work to look for changes.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
And
Dr.
Garrity, would an increase in appetite almost always be also accompanied by an increase in thirst? In other words, drinking more water? Because sometimes when they're drinking lots of water, that could indicate some kidney issues, right?
It can, yeah. With Cushing's, they don't have to always have all of the symptoms. And sometimes it's hard to know if a dog is drinking, you know, an extra cup here and there when they're taking their drink, because we're not really measuring normally. So sometimes we miss those increases in drinking. And if they urinate a little bit larger volume, we may not know that either on the walks, because no one's measuring that. So sometimes that can just go silently, but the food is noticed. And sometimes it's the other way.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Jennifer, who's on the line in Baltimore. You have a question, Jennifer, for Dr. Garrity, I guess, about vaccinations. Is that right?
Yes. I have a vet that I use in Southern Virginia. I see this vet often when I go home to Lynchburg, Virginia. And this vet, I have an 11-year-old Cocker Spaniel, and she's gave me this advice twice. She said, at this age, at 11 years old, there is no reason that I need to repeat yearly vaccinations. Usually that full slate of vaccines that kind of expire each year, the lepto and the other vaccines. She says at that age, there's no need to continue that. And I had a right as a dog owner to deny these vaccinations. Is this a new protocol? I was shocked when I heard that.
So whenever we recommend vaccines for a patient, it is really based on their lifestyle. You know, are they out there, you know, in the woods? Are they going to boarding facilities? Are they seeing other dogs in play groups? Rabies should be given and is required by law to be given. And so that one should be given on a regular schedule. Usually adult dogs are given it every 3 years. The vaccines for Lyme, lepto, Bordetella, and canine influenza, the three, Lyme, lepto, and Bordetella, are bacterial-based vaccines. Those bacterial-based vaccines do not last a long time, so they will not provide immunity beyond a year. Whereas rabies, distemper will. Studies have been done and challenge studies to prove that they work and have an effective titer at that time. But the bacterial-based ones have to be given every year. So it really depends on, you know, your dog's lifestyle.
So it doesn't... I'm sorry, Jennifer, let me interrupt here for a second. What Jennifer is asking, I think, maybe is about the age of the dog. That's really not the main thing. It's the lifestyle rather than the age. Is that right, Dr. Garrity?
Right. I mean, I have discontinued distemper in some elderly patients, but I still do recommend the other vaccines unless they are not exposed to boarding kennels, play groups, dog parks, things like that. But leptospirosis can be carried by wild animals, and that is a disease that can cause liver failure and kidney failure.
Yeah, but Jennifer, you're saying your dog is 11 years old. That's not super old. It's not super young either.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he has health problems, and I do board him. And I live in the city, so I'm really cautious about staying up to date with his lift, though.
That's great. Yeah, that's great. And if he does go to boarding facilities, he should be up to date on canine influenza and Bordetella.
What is the doctor's basis for making that recommendation? Is it causing harm? Would it shorten his lifespan if I continue the full slate of vaccine?
No. I think it's just trying to, reduce the amount of vaccines that we have to put into the immune system. Most of the time, we do recommend vaccinating continuously on a regular basis, unless there is some underlying reason not to, like an immune reaction, an adverse reaction, or something like that. Okay. Yeah, there's no set guideline.
All right. Well, thank you, Jennifer, for that call. Some wonderful, very, very important questions. We're going to take a quick break. It's Midday on Pets. Dr. Lisa Garrity is with us. She's the medical director at the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital. We will have more with Dr. Garrity when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. We do have some more questions about vaccines that we'll talk about. We'll talk about how to care for some of the older pets, the senior pets. Whatever's on your mind with your pets, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, it's Midday on the Arts. Kate Bergen, the new director of the Walters Art Museum, will tell us about the Walters Latin American Art Show. And Marco Merrick of the Community Concert Choir of Baltimore talks about their show at Carnegie Hall. Plus, a review of the rock opera L'Empira from our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Pets. You are welcome to call us or drop us an email and tell us about whatever pet holds a special place in your heart and house. Is it a Daisy, a Max, a Bruno, a Simba, a Bella? Maybe you have siblings, Boots and Laces, or a bunny named Mr. Hops. I once had a special dog named Broccoli back in the day. Great, great dog. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Dr. Lisa Garrity is with us. She's the medical director of the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital, and she joins us to answer your question. So, Dr. Garrity, when we talk about allergies, we have a couple of questions about that. Email from Margaret, for example, who says, I have a cat who lost a lot of patches of hair, and it turned out he had an allergy to fish. Is that unusual? We talked about Rachel Bay's dog's allergy to chicken. How about cats being allergic to fish? Do you see that often?
Yes, actually, cats with food allergy is not as common as dogs, but cats do have, the number one allergy is fish. At least that's what a dermatologist, veterinary dermatologist told me. So yes, that is a thing. I have a cat that actually has environmental allergies, and she loses patches of hair, Lena. So I know how frustrating it is with allergies in cats. They're not easy to medicate.
Yeah. Are there sort of telltale signs that a dog or a cat is allergic to something? I mean, human beings, our eyes get watery, we sneeze a lot. Sometimes there's even more severe consequences to, allergies to pollen, et cetera. How about with doggies and kitties?
So with dogs and food allergies, the most common signs are yeast infection in the ears. They get a brown discharge in their ears that is almost classic for food allergies. They will chew their paws in between their pads, and they can sometimes have anal gland issues, whether they're licking a lot back there. So those are kind of the three big ones with food allergy in dogs. And in cats, it's usually food allergy scratching around their face, losing patches of hair, having scabbing or crusting on their ears, things like that. We don't, cats can get eye discharge, but not as common of as dogs do with allergic conjunctivitis. I don't see allergic conjunctivitis very much in cats.
We have an email with a question about rabies vaccine. Does my cat, who will never go outdoors, require a rabies vaccine? We have no other pets. This is Stephen who's listening and sends us an email. So even if the cat doesn't go outside, what does the law say about a rabies shot?
The law says is that they do need to be vaccinated. All domestic pets have to be vaccinated, horses, you know, you name it, because rabies is a fatal disease in humans. You know, we have to prevent it and try and keep the rabies incidences down, you know, so every pet has to be vaccinated for rabies.
All right, that's
because
great.
The thing is, rabies can be carried by bats, and bats can get into homes. And so even though the cat doesn't go out, there is always that potential.
Yeah, and if someone's visiting the house or something, I mean, there are all sorts of stuff could happen, yeah. All right, well, that's pretty cut and dry. We have an email from Donna who says, we have an adorable Cairn Terrier who is 15 months old, and at 6 months, he started relentlessly chasing shadows. A dog behaviorist recommended Prozac and daily walks and lots of activity, but it didn't really help. We noticed a drop-off even in his appetite and energy, so we stopped it after 4 months. Will he ever outgrow this love of chasing shadows? So this is something that this little puppy started at 6 months old. Is this a phase, or is this going to be something that the puppy does all for his whole life?
I think he's going to need some training to get out of that. That's just an obsessive compulsive disorder that we do see that behavior in terriers. They are a working breed. They want to be doing something all the time. And if they don't have an outlet for that energy, is they're going to create this behavior, this obsessive compulsive behavior. So, you know, behavioral training, get a trainer in to try and desensitize to the chasing of the shadows. Try and redirect to something like a puzzle toy, definitely activity, walks, things like that, yeah.
Dr. Lisa Garrity is the medical director at the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital. It's Midday on Pets. If you have a question, 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wypr.org. Let's go back to the phones. Catherine is on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the program with Dr. Garrity.
Thank you so much. I have a question about international travel for cats and dogs, and I'm wondering if the Trump administration's cuts in the USDA is going to affect the timeline that it's going to take to get a certificate to travel internationally. And what experience do you have recently with the USDA? Thank you.
All right, any
yes,
experience?
That's a very good question. A lot of the doctors in my office have been talking about it. Because international travel with cats and dogs requires a health certificate endorsed by the USDA APHIS department, and the veterinarians in that department has been, you know, definitely affected by the cuts. And right now, I have not seen a delay in those certificates getting approved or endorsed, but I assume that might happen. So yeah, we're keeping a close eye on it.
All right, thanks for that call. It's difficult to know, of course, from day to day, even from hour to hour, what's going on with some of the departments,
exactly.
You know, given the DOGE influence, et cetera. So that is the kind of thing that you're just going to have to really stay on top of, because that policy could change. We had a farmer on the show a few weeks ago, Lisa Lane from Two Boots Farm, whose contract with the USDA had been very abruptly stopped. She was going to install some solar panels in her farm. And I heard just last Sunday that, in fact, that has been restarted. The USDA has changed their policy about that. So Two Boots Farm will get their solar panels with the help of a contract and a grant program from the USDA. So things change literally from day to day and week to week. So stay on top of it. So Dr. Garrity, I want to ask you about the special needs and challenges that older pets have. And I want to ask you about pet and grieving. We have a caller, Corinne, who calls and left a message on our listener line with a question in that regard. Here's what she had to say.
I have a cat. Her name is Cher. I had another cat named Onyx but unfortunately, I had to put her down last August. Cher has been loving and so supportive and just incredible since then, but she's definitely shown some symptoms of boredom. She's also peeing outside the litter box, which she has never done since getting spayed. And I'm just at a loss with, she's very food obsessed. She stares at her food bowl all day. I don't know if it's grief or just boredom, or I just not sure what to do. Would love some insight. Thank you.
It depends on how old Cher is. If it was a year ago that she lost her other cat, which I'm really sorry for your loss. It's hard. Believe me, I know. You know, I don't think that it's grief at this point. I mean, she may be a cat that does love other cats, so maybe she needs another cat in the environment. But if she's an older cat, you know, definitely if she's urinating outside the box and she's always wanting food, is I start to think if she's senior, I start to think of things like hyperthyroidism. And so she might want to have a discussion with her vet about, is there a medical reason for her to be acting this way? But if she's a younger cat, then it may just be that she needs some kind of environmental enrichment.
Yeah, I mean, animals do absolutely grieve, do they not? I mean, I had that experience with this dog I mentioned earlier, Broccoli, because Broccoli grew up with an Irish setter named Murphy, and then Murphy left, and Broccoli was by herself, and it was terrible. She was really in bad shape because she and Murphy just played, you know, constantly together. And she stopped eating. She did, mm-hmm. and I had to feed her. I had to kind of feed her one pellet at a time to get her back to normal. And it took a few weeks for her to, you know, sort of find her bearings. And speaking of eating, the possibilities for dog food and cat food seem to be endless now. We see them advertised on television, all these specialty foods, stuff you keep in the refrigerator, stuff that's, basically marketed as being good enough to eat yourself. When you come up with, when your clients ask you for recommendations about food, how do you help them make that decision, what brand of food they're going to eventually settle on?
Well, because I can't keep up with all of those different, you know, what we call boutique diets. I often just recommend the ones that I feed my dog or that I'm used to, you know, seeing on the market, and I know that they have research behind. So I often recommend those. I do not support, you know, raw diets. I really think that that can get into a lot of trouble with, you know, zoonotic diseases, E. coli, salmonella, you know, things like that. I just don't recommend that.
So it's not necessarily the case that you're going to be improving your dog's health or, you know, longevity by some of these fancy schmancy foods that you see advertised all over the place.
I mean, I don't know that much about them. I do have some clients that are on them and I just monitor them. A lot of those dogs have lost weight, which I think is positive. But I don't know that much about those diets because it's just so hard to keep up on so many.
Dr. Lisa Garrity is the medical director at the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday on Pets. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and continue to answer your questions about your cats, your dogs, your frogs, your rabbits, whatever you got. Dr. Garrity is generously here until the top of the hour. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Pets. Dr. Lisa Garrity, medical director at the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital, is taking questions about your pets. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. www.mbsmedia.org. We have a few folks who left questions on our listener line, including Jessica Bachin, who's actually the intern here at Midday. And she was nice enough to make a question that has to do with what we were talking a little bit about before the break, a senior animal. Here's what Jessica wants to know about Dr. Garrity.
I have a question about vaccine. I have a Maltese that is 7 years old, and she has already been vaccinated when she was younger. But do you have any recommendation about vaccine, or is there something I should keep in mind as my dog gets older?
All right, so what do you think, Dr. Garrity? As the dogs start to get into middle age, if not older age, we talked a little bit about this before, but vaccines, you know, there's a schedule for those things, right?
Yeah, there is a schedule for them. Once they've gone through their puppy series, then again, those bacterial-based and yearly vaccines are done once a year. Distemper eventually is an every 3-year vaccine, and rabies every 3 year. And we still do recommend vaccines based on the manufacturer's, you know, instructions and the AVMA vaccine guidelines. And we tailor it to lifestyle. So if the Maltese doesn't go to the dog park or the boarding facility, then, you know, there may not be a need for the Bordetella or the canine influenza. As long as you're diligent with, you know, flea and tick prevention and heartworm prevention, you know, you may not want, you may not need the Lyme vaccine if she's really not outside very much. But leptospirosis, you know, I still would recommend, and then rabies and distemper, you know, at the normal intervals.
All right, and we appreciate that question from Jessica. Let's go back to the phones. This is a caller from Cockeysville. Rosalind, welcome to Midday with Dr. Lisa Garrity.
Yes, good morning. I have an Australian Shepherd who suffers from separation anxiety, and I have to give her medication from time to time, maybe to calm her if I'm going to be gone for long periods of time. And she's very difficult to give pills to.
So Dr. Garrity, so it's an 8-year-old Australian Shepherd with some separation anxiety issues, but given her pills can be a challenge. Any suggestions?
There is always a way to have medications compounded into a flavored chew or a liquid, and that may be a better way that she could then mix the medication into a small amount of food. If it's a flavored liquid beef or chicken, that might work for her. But it's interesting that she only has to medicate the separation anxiety periodically. That's actually kind of good. Most separation anxiety patients need medication on a daily basis, like Prozac or something like that.
All right, Rosalind, are you back? And can you hear us?
Yes, thank you. Oh. I was hesitant to give her the Prozac, and that does require blood work as well. And like so many of your other callers, going to the vet costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
It does. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's a tough decision to make. Okay, well, thank you for that call. I appreciate it. And Dr. Garrity, we have a question from Thomas, who's in Frederick. Any recommendations about avian flu and cats? And also, what about FLV and FIV, which I guess refers to feline leukemia, etc.?
Mm-hmm. Well, with the bird flu, you know, we do recommend not feeding the raw food, since that seems to be how some of the cases have been contracted. Indoor outdoor cats, you know, can be at risk, I guess, from the wildlife, or if they're on a farm that has, chickens or other birds. So, you know, there's no vaccine for it for pets. It's just trying to eliminate exposure. The feline leukemia virus, we do recommend vaccinating. And the AAFP, or American Association of Feline Practitioners, is recommending to have kittens vaccinated at least in their first year to provide immunity, even if they're not going to be going outside, to prevent those accidental escapes or exposures to that virus. It reduces, you know, the incidence of that disease. And for feline and FIV, feline immunodeficiency virus, there is no vaccine for it. Unfortunately, that is just with screening. You know, periodically, when you first get a cat, you would screen for those viruses. And then if they're indoor and you don't bring other cats in that could have the virus, then they will not get it.
That's Dr. Lisa Garrity, the medical director of the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital. It's Midday on Pets. I'm Tom Hall. If you have a question, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. So, Dr. Garrity, back to caring for the older pets in your life. Are there things, particular, you know, symptoms or behaviors that one should keep an eye out for to make sure that the older little guys and girls are in decent shape? What should we be looking out for?
Yeah, we love the geriatric patients. They're so fun. They're just adorable. They do have different needs than younger or even just the mature adults. Often it's mobility issues where they have joint pain, joint inflammation. They often do go through muscle loss, cognitive decline, and then decreased vision and hearing. One of the things I talk with my clients about when I see a geriatric patient, I said, oh, he's getting, you know, the age to his eyes, the eyes turn blue. And that is a disease, that's an aging process called lenticular sclerosis, where the lens gets more water in it. And so it's harder for light to get in there. So turning the lights on in a dark stairwell or turning the lights on when they go out at night, having night lights at lower levels, you know, down hallways helps. And the lenticular sclerosis is a graying or bluing of the eye, where cataracts is where the lens gets hard and crystallized. And the cataracts, which are not as common as lenticular sclerosis, cataracts do impede vision, you know, significantly.
Yeah, that's great suggestions. Those are great suggestions. As you know, as humans age, their eyesight gets worse and their hearing gets worse. So some parallels there with our geriatric dogs and cats as well. Let's go back to the phone. Samantha is on the line in Bel Air. Welcome to the show with Dr. Garrity.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And what's on your mind?
So I have a cat who is about 7 years old, and he has mycoplasma. And he's had mycoplasma for a number of years. He is, frankly, a snotty mess. And he is on antibiotics. He's been on them a couple times, but he just can't seem to kick it. And our vet keeps telling us that one course should do it, but it's just not working. Is there any suggestions that you would have for different medications we could try or other treatments?
I mean, no, that's probably difficult. I mean, you could definitely, you know, consider a culture and make sure that, you know, there's not secondary bacteria there that has to be treated. You could try probiotics, probiotics to stimulate the immune system, make sure he doesn't have things like feline, you know, immunodeficiency virus. But yeah, that's a tough one. Has he had any rhinoscopy, you know, to see if there is, you know, any problems, you know, up in the nose?
So they've tried to do that one or two times, but he's very blocked. And so it'd be really hard. Yeah. They'd have to put him out under, and that's just, yeah.
Yeah, that's tough.
He's a snotty guy. It's very gross.
Yeah,
try the, you know, the probiotics, Immuniquin, Fortiflora, you know, something like that. That might help him, you know, try and fight it a little bit better. But yeah, courses of antibiotics, you know, long-term.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Samantha. That's a tough one. And good luck with your little kitty. That's a challenge, to be sure. Let's go to Mary, who's on the line in Baltimore. Mary, welcome to the show.
I have a question about my cat. She's 14. She has recurring ear infections, and the vet has prescribed various eardrops and has shown me when we're there how to put them in, but I just, and there's two of us, like one of us tries to hold her and the other one tries to put them in, but she manages somehow to get away, or even if she doesn't, she just like shakes her head and the medicine goes flying all over our faces. So I was just wondering if you had any tips to help us with that.
Yeah, that's a challenge for lots of folks.
Yeah, do they know why she has the ear infections? Does she have polyps in there? Has she been on a food diet trial to kind of, you know, reduce the inflammation in the ears? Because food allergies can present that way too. You know, you could put the medication on, you know, a gloved finger and rub it in there rather than having to put a huge volume in and see if that's an easier way. Then you can actually get it on the surface. That might help.
Okay. Yeah, she hasn't been put on a food trial. I mean, there was no mention of the possibility of allergies, food allergies. So,
how long has it been that she's been like this?
The last time it happened was about a year ago, and then there was one, it happened before that, about a year before that as well.
Yeah, so maybe a diet trial, even just eliminating the most common allergen, you know, for cats, which is fish. You know, there's rabbit diets, you know, there's duck diets. Duck doesn't usually cross over, but you could stay away from that as well. But yeah, try a diet trial and then try, you know, putting the medication, you know, with a gloved finger on rather than having the liquid sitting in there so she can't shake it out all over the place. But yeah, tough.
Yeah, that is tough. Well, good luck, Mary. Certainly hope she's doing okay. We are almost out of time, but let's see if we can sneak one more call in. Let's go to Victoria, who's calling, I guess, about weight loss with pets. What's on your mind, Victoria, real quick?
Yes, I wanted to ask the vet, what is the best way to get a dog to lose weight?
Well, that's a pretty big question. It depends on how old the dog is, how active the dog is. We do have to balance calorie intake with, you know, energy out, like exercising. So we do need to get them moving, get them exercising, to make sure that they're not getting into other foods, to make sure there's no underlying medical reason like Cushing's or thyroid. There's a lot of parameters to try and get a dog to lose weight, to make sure that you are, you know, not giving too many treats, not giving table foods. I've had clients where they found out their dog was getting into the cat food and that's why it was gaining weight. So, you know, really just kind of evaluate the environment and increase the activity.
All right. Thanks for that call, Victoria. And Dr. Garrity, as we finish up here, have you ever had a situation where pets are being prescribed GLP-1s, these weight loss drugs, you know, Ozempic and Wegovy and stuff? Are pets actually taking those medications as well?
They aren't. There is something similar, but it's for diabetes in cats. There's a liquid and a pill that blocks, you know, glucose, but not specifically the ones for weight loss. But I have heard that there is one in research right now.
There
so I haven't seen a name or if it's going to be coming out soon. Yeah. But.
Why am I not surprised? All right. Well, Dr. Lisa Garrity, the medical director at Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital, thank you so much. It's always great having you on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been fun. Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on the Arts. We'll talk to the director of the Walters Art Museum, the director of the Community Concert Choir of Baltimore, and our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Up next, it's Fresh Air. The guest is Walter Goggins. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day. We'll be right back.